From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. In 1910, British comedy impresario Fred Carno brought his vaudeville show, A Night in an English Music Hall, to tour the States. In that troupe were two comedians who would become famous in American cinema, Charlie Chaplin and his understudy, Stan Laurel. Chaplin started his film career with Mack Sennett's Keystone Studios, where Ford Sterling, Roscoe Arbuckle, and Mabel Normand were the stars. These earliest of Chaplin's films were played over and over, cut and recut, retitled and retitled again. They were old and faded and difficult to watch. Recently, the Keystone work of Charlie Chaplin was painstakingly restored, and it turns out to be an essential part of Chaplin's work. Tonight, James L. Niebuhr returns to our show. He's written about the films of Buster Keaton and Jerry Lewis, and now a careful study of Chaplin's work for Keystone. The book is called Early Charlie Chaplin, The Artist as Apprentice at Keystone Studios. James L. Niebuhr, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Gary.
So why are Chaplin's Keystones so poorly regarded?
Well, I think it's because when we look at the deeper and more fulfilling later films of Chaplin, like The Kid and The Gold Rush and City Lights and Modern Times, and we go all the way back to 1914 and look at some of the most primitive comedies and movies ever made, because motion pictures themselves were only like, you know, 20, 25 years old, their entire history. They seem very crude and very simple and very just, you know, silly and slapsticky. But there was a method to the madness at Keystone, and the fact that these are Charlie Chaplin's first films, where he first created the iconic Little Tramp character, where he first learned comedy direction, and there's a genuine and definite evolution, not only in the development of the what we understand as a movie star, but also in the development of the construction of comedy films, the way the camera is used, the way editing is used, the way performances are a little more subtle in some ways and a little more boisterous in others. That's all within the 36 films that Chaplin made at Keystone. And they were poorly regarded in another sense, even by veteran comedy buffs, because, as you stated in your introduction, the Keystone films, when Chaplin left Keystone, his popularity just soared to amazing heights. And Mack Sennett owned these movies at Keystone, and he thought, well, you know, I'm going to bank on this. So he would lease them out. He would re-release them. Sometimes they would be cut and released and with a different title in order to try to fool the public that this might be a new Chaplin movie. And after so many, you know, releases and re-releases, and then later on, the films were no longer under copyright, so they could be put on 8mm films for toy projectors back in the 50s and 60s. They could be used as 16mm prints as filler in early television, just to, you know, like after a ball game. They were just, you know, really kind of torn apart, and fortunately, they all still existed because of this, the fact that, you know, because there's so many lost films from the silent era, it's fortunate that they all still existed because of this sort of treatment, but it was very hard to watch them. When you would watch the Keystone films on a cheap VHS tape you would find, say somebody wanted to, you know, learn about this great Charlie Chaplin, and they bought a $6 VHS or later DVD collection of his films, they'd see these Keystones, and they'd be grainy and sometimes edited in the wrong order, and it would just be a confusing mess. And the people would say, this is the greatest comedian of all time. It might even turn them off to silent pictures or even to black and white movies if they were a younger viewer and their investigation netted this, you know, uninteresting work. But now that the British Film Institute has painstakingly restored these films to as close to their natural state as possible, we can look at and savor and appreciate the crudity, the development, and the creative process of Charlie Chaplin, one of the truly iconic figures in American cinema.
You know, when we look at, a television series that was on for a long time, like, say, I don't know, All in the Family or The Simpsons or something, when you look at an early episode, you can see that the characters aren't fully developed the way you think of them after having watched the series over a period of time. Is that what happens when you watch these Keystone Chaplins?
Well, in a sense it is, yeah. Chaplin already had the rudiments of the character kind of as he went along at Keystone. I think it's cinema itself grew up very quickly, and when you consider the subtlety and depth of a film like The Kid, and then you go all the way back to something like His Trysting Place, which is a raucous slapstick comedy, both are very brilliant in their own way, but one is from 1914, one is from 1921, and in that seven-year period, the motion picture itself grew tremendously. And when you figure from 1921 to 1930, by 1930 there were talking movies and everything else, and that's only 9 years later. The motion picture grew just incredibly quickly. When you figure modern literature is like the past 100 years, and almost the entire history of motion pictures is, you know, like about 100 years, a little more than that. It really puts things into perspective that the movies grew very, very quickly and haven't been around as long when compared to, like, music and literature. So when you look at these very primitive films, they're primitive from that perspective because of the growth of cinema as well as the development of a character. Because I believe Chaplin's character, through a lot of experimentation, grew very quickly within that 1 year. And remember, it was only 1 year that he worked at Keystone. The 36 films that Chaplin made for Keystone is just a little bit more than a series run for one season back as far back as when All in the Family was being done.
Yeah, that's true. When you look at the films now, the other night after having read your book, I pulled out my box set from Flickr Alley, and I was looking at Doe and Dynamite, which is one of the films that you said was really a great one. And it is really great, but it's kind of a longer one. That's like a three-reeler?
Yeah, that's it's extended a little bit longer. There were some real strict budgetary concerns that Sennett had being a producer. He was essentially a businessman. He was a business owner, despite some level of creativity and some ideas for presenting comedy on screen, which at that time were innovative. He was pretty strict about the budgets, and he didn't like his comedians to go over budget. But in the sense of Doe and Dynamite, there were some real misgivings about the fact that it went so far over budget. But the film was so funny, and it was so well received, that Sennett didn't mind so much when the film still turned a pretty enormous profit. And there's a lot going on in Doe and Dynamite, not only the comedy, but there's an underlying subtext that's a little more serious, and it showed that Chaplin had ideas to carry cinema a little bit further than its immediate trappings at that time.
You can see the hints of the later Chaplin that we were talking about a second ago. But I did notice there's not a lot of close-ups. It's almost all long shots.
Yeah, there is a lot about... Keystone had to have a certain rhythm. There had to be sort of a physical rhythm to their comedy. And Chaplin, although being a little bit more subtle than the standard Keystone performer... tried to maintain that rhythm because he was working for a company, and the company had a product, and the product had some expectations by its audience, or its fans, as you will. And while Chaplin elevated himself beyond that in a lot of ways, he still wanted to maintain that rhythm. So in the sense of Doe and Dynamite, there's a lot of movement within the frame. There's the cinematic term is mise-en-scène, a French term, where it's where things are placed, the composition within the shot, within the frame. And Chaplin makes sure to compose the shot where this is going on over here, this is going on over there, but this in the foreground has your immediate attention, and the background is just supporting what's in the foreground as per its rhythm, as per its presentation. And so with the medium shot, you can show all of that. Whereas a close-up, that's to show a specific character, a specific emotion that wasn't particularly necessary in the type of film that Doe and Dynamite was, the type of structure. The close-up was already pretty well established. A few years earlier, D.W. Griffith used it very effectively in a 1911 film called Musketeers of Pig Alley, where he was showing the grimacing faces of the tough street gang members in order to elicit some sort of apprehension or fear from the audience. At that time, that was really effective. Well, 3 years later, when Chaplin's making a film, if he wanted to convey that sort of emotion within the context of a character, naturally he would have used the close-up. But in Doe and Dynamite, I think the characters, it's more about what they're doing and how they're performing, Chaplin with his ballet-like grace, performing slapstick routines, the physical confrontations between the even smaller Chester Conklin, who was a Keystone stalwart and one of Chaplin's best friends. All of that needed medium and long shots in order to convey what Chaplin was trying to present.
He wanted his whole body in the shot?
Yeah, absolutely, because there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on in the periphery that was necessary to the overall shot.
We're talking with James L. Niebuhr, and his latest book is called Early Charlie Chaplin, The Artist as Apprentice at Keystone Studios. And by virtue of that title, we can reason that he was an apprentice to somebody. Who were his mentors at Keystone?
Well, you know, when he first got there, he was pretty much an apprentice to the actual act of making films. He had come from the stage, and his gestures were very broad, as were the Keystone gestures, and so he fit in very well. But then he realized that the camera was much more intimate, and he could be more subtle. So he was playing off of and learning from the Keystone actors, sometimes learning what not to do. One of the biggest stars on the Keystone lot was Ford Sterling, who was a very big star at that time. He's a funny guy, and he had a lot of great ideas for his time, but he had the really broad gestures where, you know, big arms wiping his eyes if he got hit with a pie rather than just, you know, responding to it more subtly, things like that. And that's what Chaplin was looking at and learning from. Is there a smaller way, a more intimate way, a more studied way of doing this that would be funnier, that would add more to the character that I'm trying to present? So his apprenticeship was essentially to the movie business itself, to the learning process of experience within the movie industry.
So who were his significant collaborators then? You mentioned Ford Sterling. What about Mabel Normand, Fatty Arbuckle?
Well, now, Arbuckle was already emerging as a star at about the same time. Chaplin surpassed him, but I would imagine that during a good portion of the silent era, Arbuckle might have been the second most famous comedian in films, because he also had an approach. He was very bombastic and a big, heavy-set guy, but he had a great agility, and he also had sort of a more subtle approach as he went on. It can be considered that he had the same idea as Chaplin, might have maybe learned something from having worked with Chaplin. But in the sense of Mabel Normand, I think he learned a great deal from her because she had a keen eye as to how to create and construct a film. She's probably the first great female director in all of cinema, any genre, not just comedy. And she really has never gotten her due because her later life was beset with scandal and she died very young in 1930. So the only people that know her are people who know her from Charlie Chaplin movies or from Keystone comedies. What Mabel was able to present as early as 1913, even in 1914, when she would occasionally direct herself or have some sort of say in the production, was an approach to the film that was able to maintain like a different levels. There would be something going on over here, like in Mabel's Strange Predicament, which was one of Chaplin's earliest films, which Mabel Normand directed. Chaplin was, you know, she would have things going on like in a hotel lobby involving Chaplin and a separate plot upstairs in the hotel among the rooms involving her. And these two things eventually met, and they never. And she would cut in between them, cross-cut from this scene to that scene to this scene to that scene, and they would somehow blend together. They never seemed real separate. A lot of earlier films couldn't pull that off as well, and Norman had that keen sort of eye. She sort of mentored Chaplin later on because she had a rooting interest in him and could see his potential. So when she would direct a film in which Chaplin appeared, she'd allow him into the cutting room where she was editing and so forth.
She did her own editing too?
Yeah, I believe that was on Caught in the Cabaret, a film that she and Chaplin did together. A lot of people say that that's a co-directed film by Chaplin and Mabel Normand, but the existing records indicate that Mabel Normand did direct that film alone. Chaplin might have offered suggestions, which she accepted, but he gets no credit in the existing Senate records. So I think that the fact that she brought him into the cutting room, because the cutting was part of the direction back then. They really didn't have a lot of people doing a lot of things. This was cinema's infancy, and so even if there was somebody else cutting the film, physically cutting the film, the director would be choosing how long this should last before it cuts away to that for the greatest comic effect. Like I said, it had to have a certain rhythm. There was a certain beat, and everybody kind of knew what they were doing. So Chaplin coming into the cutting room and looking at the rushes and being with Mabel when she decided which scene worked better among those shot, which one would, should have been included, and how long they should hold a scene to until they go to the next one. All of that was something that inspired Chaplin and fascinated him, and he remembered it when he started directing himself.
Well, Mabel Normand, I believe she had her own studio later, and she even made some features. Have you ever seen any of those films?
I saw Mickey and The Extra Girl. Mickey she did make for Sennett, and The Extra Girl she made for Samuel Goldwyn. And she has a very, you know, nice, light, pleasant approach. And she isn't a comedian in the sense that somebody like Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton are. She's more, her comedies, I guess, would be more situational in their in their humor. And she has a more, a lighter, more deft approach. But she did not direct either of those movies.
Was she a physical comedian?
She was very adept at physical comedy, especially at Keystone. She would always say that she was able to do anything the guys would do on the set. And so she had a great deal of agility and really was quite fearless in that area. But I have to say a lot of the women were you know, very adept at that at the Keystone Studios. There was some, you know, somebody, you know, much older than Chaplin, like Phyllis Allen or somebody like that, who usually played, you know, Herodians of some sort. She could do the physical gestures that were necessary for Keystone comedy. Marie Dressler, a heavier woman who was a good 20 years Chaplin senior, who starred in Tilly's Punctured Romance, the very first comedy feature ever made for Keystone, in which Chaplin co-starred. She does the pratfalls and the, you know, with as much aplomb as any Keystone comedian.
Well, scantily clad for the era, women were a big part of the Keystone studio trademark, the bathing beauties, as they were known. Do they appear in any of Chaplin's shorts?
Those came along later.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. The Max Sennett bathing beauties came along well, a little bit later on. You'll see them show up in, like, well, right now I'm finishing up a book on Harry Langdon, who worked at Sennett Studios for a while, mm-hmm. which at, by that time it was no longer called Keystone, because the Keystone period of Sennett was back in the Chaplin day. And Harry Langdon was making movies in the mid-1920s, and you'll see the Max Sennett bathing beauties appear in a couple of his films, but they came along a little later.
You know, it's interesting. I think now that you're telling me that you're going to write about Langdon, it does seem that a lot of the kind of the history doesn't always fit into the neat little package that historians have tried to put it over the years. For instance, you know, people say that Arbuckle's career just ended, and that was the end of Arbuckle in 1921 or whatever it was when he hit his scandals. But in fact, he went on and made sound pictures. And I guess the popular myth about Langdon is that he was a guy who didn't understand his own character. This is coming from, I guess, Frank Capra's book, The Name Above the Title. And
yeah.
Capra said how he didn't understand his own character, that he was a prima donna, and once he took control of his career plummeted, and he never did anything good again.
Yeah, absolutely false.
Yeah.
That's, Harry Langdon had developed that character on the vaudeville stage years before, and Frank Capra didn't start working with him until his, like, you know, I don't know the exact number, but it's like maybe his 9th movie or something, like maybe 11th movie. So Harry Langdon was finding ways to use his stage character in the context of Sennett films when he was making his movies. And Frank Capra and Arthur Ripley and Harry Edwards and other people that Langdon worked with had a lot to do with Langdon's success, because they had good ideas and Langdon worked with them in a collaborative way. But when Capra left Langdon, the films that Langdon directed himself, which were pretty much out of circulation for a long time, they're actually quite good. Three's a Crowd, which was directed by Langdon, was, and I think is an exceptionally great silent film. The problem was, at that time, audiences just simply got tired of what Langdon had to offer, and they were not successful at the box office. Well, and Capra likes to say, well, he was a prima donna and he didn't. Well, actually, that's not true. Langdon was a very talented, very gifted comedian with a lot of excellent ideas, and as helpful as Frank Capra or Arthur Ripley or Harry Edwards or any of his production company might have been, it was still Langdon's vision that was being utilized throughout his motion picture career.
Well, I guess, unfortunately for Langdon, he didn't live as long as Frank Capra.
Well, the problem with Harry Langdon is that he started late. I mean, he was almost 40 when he made his very first movies. And by the time he started directing, as he, you know, started to get somewhat of a foothold on film direction, bam, Talking Pictures took over. The entire motion picture industry was turned inside out, and he didn't have a chance to direct. I mean, Charlie Chaplin directed movies for 50 years. Langdon directed movies for like 1 year. He really didn't have a chance to, you know, develop a particular style. But the films that exist that he did direct have a lot of fascinating ideas and are much better than their reputation. Frank Capra was upset at being fired by the Langdon Corporation, and he had a personal vendetta, and he maintained it for the rest of his life. And unfortunately, a lot of people still believe that, even though it's been refuted in other studies.
Well, your books, we're talking with James L. Niebuhr. His latest book is called Early Charlie Chaplin. Your books are wonderful surveys of a period of time in an artist's career, but you don't really write biographies.
No, it's not so much the life that interests me, you know, how many times they were married or whatever scandal, unless they particularly and carefully pertain to the work that they're doing. It's the artist's work that interests me. You know, I don't care what happened in their lives, you know, 90 years ago. I care about the fact that what they created, the films that they made, the, you know, if I see a great piece in an art museum, I don't know that I want to know who the artist might have been sleeping with at the time. Maybe somebody else does. I'm more interested in the work, and that's why I write the type of books that I do. Now, with somebody like Chaplin, and I think I wrote this in one of my previous books, is you can write just a book on the Shakespeare sonnets and get a great book out of that. You don't have to write a broad overview of everything Shakespeare did. Well, the same with Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or Harry Langdon. My Harry Langdon book is just on his silent films. The talkies will be discussed in a concluding chapter. They'll be acknowledged, not assessed. Whereas the Chaplin book that I just had released, that's just on his Keystone period, because just a broad overview of all of Chaplin's films doesn't give the attention necessary to each period, which are very, very different and very, very significant. Same with Buster Keaton. I recently did a book for the same publisher called The Fall of Buster Keaton, which we talked about on a previous show of yours, which dealt with just Keaton's talkies, which are unfortunately unfairly maligned, and I wanted to correct that. Well, with the Chaplin Keystones, I wanted to do the same thing, and just that portion of a particularly poor particular performer's career really needs to be examined more closely. And so I pick a particular area and I focus on that.
Well, James Niebuhr, when you're sitting around watching these films and working on your books, you're sitting there and you're watching, you know, the Fatal Mallet or the Face in the Barroom Floor or whatever. And are you sitting there thinking, this is very interesting, and using the pause button and going back? Or do you just sit there and watch and laugh? Do you laugh when you're watching these?
Well, you know, of course you laugh when you watch them because they're funny movies. But there's something beyond that. When you're watching a comedian like Chaplin or Keaton or Langdon, the outside of you is laughing. The superficial part of you is laughing. But every once in a while, there's that inner voice that's saying, wow, that was really a clever idea. You know, it's just natural. I guess it's like if any of us look at a sign with words on it, we automatically read the sign. We can't not read it because we know how to read. We're forced to read it if we look at it. And when you're into films like some of us are who write books about them and so forth, you can't just watch a movie and not notice things like, where the camera is or where the, you know, where things are stationed. It's not because you're looking for it or you're trying to, you know, add some pretension that isn't there. It's just natural. It's a natural way to respond to cinema because it's, you know, how you care about it. It's like, I know people that understand sports far, far better than I do, and they'll look at a baseball game with a greater depth of intelligence and a greater understanding than I ever could. Well, that's how film is to me. I mean, years ago, there was a movie, I think it was called The Train with Burt Lancaster, and at the very end of the movie, he shoots, I think the actor is Paul Winfield, he shoots the bad guy and walks away, and that's really how the movie ends. Well, there's the train, it's a long shot from way above, the train's over here on the left, the dead guy's in the middle, Burt Lancaster's walking away way on the right, and it's this great shot that's framed perfectly and a perfect way to conclude the movie. Most people would walk out and say, oh, it was a great ending when he killed the bad guy, and they wouldn't respond completely to what happened, be able to explain it and articulate it the same way, but they did get the emotional impact that I did because of the way the director, I think it was John Frankenheimer, I don't know.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way he decided to frame that particular shot. It just, they would inherently respond to that, you know, maybe even subconsciously, but they might not be able to articulate it. And I think that's what it is, you know, when I watch the Chaplin films or the Keaton films or the Harry Langdon films, of course I'm laughing at them, but at the same time, I'm finding things. And I don't pause, go back, you know, I do type different notes and ideas as I'm watching them, and then I formulate it. But the other thing is that these are films I've loved pretty much my entire life, and these are, you know, some of the things I write about I've been interested in for over 30 years and have seen time and time and time again where I understand them quite well. When I wrote my first books, this is going to be one of those, you know, walking uphill in the snow stories, but when I wrote my first books, it was before there was a VHS accessibility, and I would have to wait for the movies to come on TV and real quick write the credits down as the movie went by. I couldn't pause the TV back then. Mm-hmm. And I would have to sometimes go by memory of what happened in the movie or how it was. I have seen enough times where I could do that, but we all had to do that back then. And that's why a book like The Films of Laurel and Hardy by William Everson, an excellent book from back in the 60s,
yep.
Well, a lot of times he was going by memory, and sometimes he would assess something not quite as accurately that had later on been assessed a little bit better. It's not because Mr. Everson was doing a bad job. He's magnificent. It was a wonderful book. But that's, you know, that was our limitations that many years ago. And now the access of DVD and being able to look at something and look at something again and be more careful with it, well, everybody has a different approach, but it's been much, much more helpful for those of us who really want to examine film and understand what makes them tick.
Well, we're talking with James L. Nyberg and this new book, and I recommend it to everyone. It was really a fun read and interesting. It's called Early Charlie Chaplin, The Artist as Apprentice at Keystone Studios. It's kind of a companion to the recently released box set of Chaplin at Keystone, restored by the British Film Institute. And James L. Nyberg, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf again, and I look forward to you coming back and talking Harry Langdon with us very soon.
Well, I'm finishing up the Harry Langdon book, and then I'm going to be co-writing with Terry Neamy is going to be my co-writer. She and I are going to be doing The Rise of Buster Keaton, and we're going to be talking about his 19 silent short films. We're going to be examining those. So that's the next project I'll be working on. I think this probably sounds funny, but I think I'll have Harry Langdon done by Friday. that's, I know how ridiculous that sounds, but we are pretty much wrapping that one up. So then Terry and I are going to be collaborating, and we're already doing the preliminary research on The Rise of Buster Keaton. So that'll be the next fun, interesting project I'll be tackling.
A couple of great projects to look forward to then for us here on From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much, James Nyberg.
Okay, great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Well, Well, that closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and check us out on Facebook. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I want to thank James L. Nyber, my guest this week. His latest book, Early Charlie Chaplin, The Artist as Apprentice, at Keystone Studios. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.